which is attacking Arab and Islamic countries and committing massacres and genocide against our people in Gaza, is to confront, stand firm, and provide all necessary support to the oppressed Palestinian people and their noble and honorable resistance. We will continue to fulfill our religious, moral, and humanitarian duties until the aggression against Gaza stops and the siege is lifted.
Well, the Israeli genocide in Gaza is taking Palestinian lives by the hour, with the regime focusing its deadly strikes on Gaza City. Medical sources say Israel has killed at least 25 people on Monday so far, almost all of them in Gaza City. One of the latest attacks has hit Nusayrat refugee camp, killing at least one person and injuring several others. This is amid bombing of the Shifa and Hillel hospitals in the city. The former was hosting 12 newborns at the time of the strike. Gaza's health ministry says contact with a hospital and its staff is lost and that their situation is unknown. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed two more Palestinians as troopers opened fire on civilians waiting in line to get aid in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. Gaza is also reeling from a regime-imposed famine. It has killed hundreds, including a newborn and a 13-year-old boy who died from hunger on Sunday. Israel has so far killed over 66,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October 2023. The Hamas resistance movement says it has not received any new proposal from mediators Qatar and Egypt regarding a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Senior Hamas official Hisham Badran said the group is open to all ideas and proposals to stop the genocide in Gaza without compromising its demands and national principles. His remarks came after U.S. President Donald Trump expressed optimism that a deal is near to end the war in Gaza. Badran said this is not the first time the American side has spoken about numerous initiatives and ideas, but it takes time before those initiatives are offered to Hamas through mediators. He stressed that the movement has not received any proposals related to the remarks that are being currently circulated by Trump or others. Badran said Hamas's demands are national and are made in full consultation with the Palestinian factions. He stressed that Hamas is keen to stop the war, but Israel uses the resistance's weapons as pretext to continue its war of extermination in Gaza. Well, Spain has decided to join the Hague Group, which seeks to impose new sanctions on Israel in order to stop the ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. The Spanish government's decision was announced on the sidelines of the 80th UN General Assembly meeting. The Hague Group is a 34-nation coalition whose goal is to mount pressure on Israel and end its impunity for atrocities committed in Gaza. It also means to uphold the rulings of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court in relation to Israel's aggression against Palestinians. The group's agenda includes a wide range of measures, such as banning the export of dual-use equipment to Israel, prohibiting military shipments through member states' ports, and terminating public contracts with institutions that support the occupation. It also intends to enforce oil sanctions and other punitive measures against the Tel Aviv regime. We earlier discussed this issue with political commentator Robert Inlakish. He said Spain's move is a major blow to Israel on public relations level, but it is not enough to stop the genocide in Gaza.
Well, Spain has shown itself to actually be one of those governments in Europe that has decided to take a moral stance. It has taken some time, we may note, but Spain, of course, has canceled three different weapon sales. It has broken off ties in many ways, but still it has relations with the Israelis. It still maintains relations, which is a surprise when you consider that they're openly accusing the Israelis at this point of genocide, and they have joined on to the Hague Group. And despite these efforts, attempting to hold the Israelis accountable and uphold international law, they fall short of being capable of actually stopping the Israelis from committing their genocide. In terms of what it does on a, let's say, a public relations level, this is a major blow to the Israelis on a public relations level. And it is another dent as well put on the regime. So there is an effect, there is an impact that this does have, despite there being elements that are symbolic, of course. Is it enough? Evidently not. The genocide is still going on and escalating, but is it making a difference? Yes. Ultimately, in the overarching scheme of things, yes, it does make an impact and a difference, especially to Israelis themselves.
And now to the occupied West Bank, where the Israeli military has carried out a mass detention campaign, abducting 7 Palestinians, including a child, and shutting down a UN-run clinic in the El Jalzoun refugee camp north of Ramallah. For more details on this, we are now joined by our correspondent, Naka Hamid. Naka, again, this is not the first time that the Israelis and the settlers have carried out such detentions. What details do you have for us there on the ground?
Yes, Caitlin. Well, since the hours of last night, the Israeli forces have been raiding Al Jalzoun refugee camp to the north of occupied Ramallah. And until these moments, they are still in Al Jalzoun and in its surrounding, arresting Palestinians and making a full movement ban towards that area. This is a very viable area for the entire north of Ramallah city, where Palestinians usually come to Ramallah from that road. And the Israeli forces have closed it since the hours of the morning. Inside Al Jalzoun refugee camp, the actual raids are going on, as we have talked to local resources from inside the refugee camp, stating that Israeli forces have been going through the homes of Al Jalzoun refugee camp, door to door and home to home, ransacking homes and searching for unidentified objects, maybe, but they are searching every home and taking the youth, the Palestinian youth, towards a field interrogation center that they have made inside Al Jalzoun refugee camp. Until now, we are talking about tens of arrests from inside Al Jalzoun refugee camp, but they remain inside. They remain inside it. They have not been taken away to detention camps or to military bases as usual. And this may indicate that they will be released in the coming hours. Of course, while raiding Al Jalzoun refugee camps, confrontations happened between the Palestinians and these raiding IOF forces. Al Jalzoun was not the only refugee camp under fire in the last couple of hours. Also, Al Amari refugee camp in Ramallah city, and also Al Arroub refugee camp to the north of occupied Al Khalil, have been under systematic attack. This is not a new thing, unfortunately, that we are saying this, but this is not a new thing to these refugee camps to be under such aggression. Well, on other places, the Israeli forces also made incursions towards Tul Kerem and Jenin this night, attacking Palestinians in the area of the Nabe and in the surrounding areas of Nur Shams and Tul Kerem refugee camps, and of course Jenin refugee camp. The situation has not settled down over there, even after almost 300 days of military aggression upon those two cities. The Palestinians, the Palestinian resistance seems over there is still trying to make hits towards the Israeli forces.
On that point, I'd like to thank you, as always, Naka Hamid, there, of course, Juan Jones from Ramallah, for those details on the latest situation from the occupied West Bank. Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will never give in to dictates of the world bullies and those countries that violate the agreements they have signed. Masoud Pezeshkian was addressing a cabinet meeting after the U.S. and 3 European parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement illegally reactivated annulled U.N. Security Council sanctions resolutions against Tehran. He said the government has made appropriate plans to deal with any possible condition, with people's livelihood taking the center stage. Pezeshkian noted that Iran made every effort to come up with a just and logical solution to the nuclear issue through negotiations, but that the opposite sides intended to deprive the country of all of its assets. He referred to a religious decree issued by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who has prohibited the production of nuclear weapons. Pezeshkian said Iran has never pursued development of nuclear weapons and has always been ready for fair and logical talks based on a well-defined criteria. However, he added Iran will never engage in negotiations that would cause new problems for the country. Iran's foreign minister has once again categorically rejected the illegal move taken by the U.S. and three European countries to reimpose annulled U.N. sanctions on the country. Abbas Araghchi made the remark in a letter to his counterparts around the world. Araghchi said the attempt by the U.S. and the E3 to reinstate sanctions previously lifted under U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 is unfounded, unlawful, and invalid. He said Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal, established mutual commitments and reciprocal assurances as the foundation of the agreement. Araghchi stressed that the U.S.'s withdrawal from the agreement and the E3's failure to fulfill their commitments have deprived them of any eligibility to invoke Resolution 2231 for any purpose. He stressed that neither Iran nor any U.N. member is under any legal obligation to comply with such unlawful measures because their recognition or implementation amounts to violation of international law. Araghchi noted that Iran will continue to defend its sovereign rights and legitimate interests firmly, while remaining open to genuine negotiations on an equal footing. Now crossing over to Pakistan, whose capital Islamabad has witnessed a massive protest on Sunday, as demonstrators rallied against the United States and the Israeli regime over the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi brings us more in this report.
Anger in the streets against the U.S. and Israel. Protesters in Islamabad burned American and Israeli flags to record their outrage against the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip and the U.S. complicity in Israeli crimes.
The United States is hand in hand for the massacre and genocide, Israeli genocide in Gaza. The United States has provided not only financial aid, but all the F-16s and all the weapons which are being used to exterminate Palestinians in Gaza.
Demonstrators held the U.S. and its European allies responsible for the killing of tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians by supplying weapons that fueled the bloodshed and for shielding Israel from international accountability.
America, which claims to be a champion of human rights, why does it turn a blind eye to Gaza? Men, women, and children are being slaughtered every day with U.S. weapons in the hands of Israel.
Protesters highlighted the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, where men, women, and children remain trapped under the siege with no access to food, medicine, or shelter.
Women are being killed by Israel, children are being killed by Israel, but no one is there to speak for them. We all know that Israel is international terrorist.
Israel is a ghasib riyasat hai.
Israel is an occupying regime and fomenting terrorism. It bombs schools, hospitals, and refugee camps. Any country that supports such brutality is supporting terrorism itself.
Many called for boycotting American and Israeli products, saying economic resistance was their way to support Palestine.
As Israeli attacks continue in Gaza, protests are spreading worldwide with calls for an end to the genocide and urgent aid for millions trapped under siege. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now. Iran.
Baluchistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, these adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahani-Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahani-Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahani-Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahani-Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The
Chaimima reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan. Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran. As we continued our tour of Arras in northwest Iran, in the remote areas of the region, I found the opportunity to learn more about its history and its folklore. It is interesting to see how villagers in these remote mountains have managed to keep all their traditions alive. Traditions that go beyond simple eating habits. Games are an inseparable part of human culture. That's why as you study any ancient civilization, you will definitely find some very old games. The village of Gulfaraj had its own museum of anthropology where I could find plenty of interesting information about the people that have been living here for thousands of years, including information about the local games that they played.
About games, most of us imagine a group of kids playing, but there are many games that even grown-ups can enjoy.
A game that is surprisingly reminiscent of baseball, making me wonder if this American sport actually originates in Iran. But anyhow, this game definitely encourages teamwork and requires a very fit body and healthy lungs. And as you can see, it is very popular among grown-ups. Even the elderly. Playing with knuckle bones, especially those of a sheep, is one of the oldest games that many ancient civilizations have in common. However, there are many different ways of using them. Most of the games are played by throwing them up and catching them in different manners. Again, another popular game among grown-ups as well as kids. Meanwhile, the dusty alleys of the village never seem to be quiet after school. The games are simple. You don't need anything special. A ball made of leftover bits and pieces of cloth and a few stones. Even a couple of pebbles are enough to keep the kids busy. And if everything else fails, there's always a song they can sing together.
Bandadusha is a popular game played by kids. It literally means capturing the violet, but I really don't know how it's played, which is why I'm joining them.
From what I learned, solidarity is the name of the game. One side loses when its human chain is broken by a member of the opposing team. And although they didn't use a sheep today, they still learned problem-solving skills and creativity. Yusumish Ahmadi for Iran.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian Voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Spotlight. In a decisive response, Iran's foreign ministry has recalled its ambassadors from London, Paris, and Berlin for consultations. This move comes just a day after the UN Security Council failed to pass a draft resolution proposed by Russia and China that sought a technical six-month delay to the sanctions to maintain a space for cooperation with the IAEA. It is being described as a direct reaction to the irresponsible action by the European trio and as a sordid mess, asserting that their intent is confrontation, not constructive dialogue. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian says Tehran will not allow IAEA inspectors to visit its nuclear sites after the activation of the snapback mechanism. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi drew a parallel to the failed military attacks by Israel and the U.S. on Iran's nuclear facilities in June, stating that the snapback mechanism will similarly fail to resolve the decades-long nuclear dispute. He emphasized that Tehran will never bow to Western pressure and that the only solution remains dialogue and diplomacy. Well, key questions now arise. What are the true objectives of the E3? Does the move signal the final death of the JCPOA? What strategic options does Iran have on the table? And what is the role of diplomacy in this new landscape? To analyze these critical issues, we are now joined by Mr. Riza Vidadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. And Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank both of you, of course, for joining us during this hour's spotlight, this episode. Mr. Vidadi, I do want to start off with you, first of all. Let's go ahead and start off with, in your opinion, what is the primary motivation for the E3 to actually trigger this snapback mechanism specifically at this time? I mean, is it an independent move or is it completely and entirely under the pressure of the United States?
I wouldn't use the word pressure. I would say it was in hand collaboration with the United States and Israel. They realized that the sanctions for the past 20, 30 years haven't worked. They realized that other political pressures didn't work. They realized that the war that they tried to instigate in June didn't work. They tried to use popular unrest or the Velvet Revolution style of regime change that they've done with other countries, like in Ukraine and other countries. That didn't work. So now they're attempting to put other pressures, and one of them is by bringing back, they believe, the sanctions, because China and Russia are disputing this legally. So they believe by bringing back this kind of pressure on Iran, they will try to put internal pressure on Iran, so cause division between different parts of Iranian political spectrum that says we should negotiate and not go to war, and also increase, for example, when they bring these snapback sanction discussions in, the Iranian currency devalues. They have people that they enable in Iran or support in Iran to fluctuate the currency and cause economic problems for the population. They've tried all the other mechanisms, so they also will use this as an excuse for Israel and United States to possibly, if they want to attack and strike Iran again, as a pretext that Iran has not abided by the JCPOA and so is entitled to be attacked.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and bring in Mr. Fantina. Mr. Fantina, let's look at some of the responses from Iran. We have Mr. Araghchi described this action as a sign of an intent to confront. Meanwhile, we have President Pezeshkian says that Tehran will, in capitalization, not allow the IAEA inspectors visit these nuclear sites. Do you believe the Europeans have now closed the window for diplomacy?
Yes, I think they have, and they've done it intentionally and very foolishly. The idea that these snapbacks are in any way legitimate is ludicrous. We remember when Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018, Iran maintained the agreement for a full year, hoping that the European countries that are signatories to the JCPOA would find a way to continue to deal with Iran despite U.S. threats. Now, the snapbacks should be against the United States, England, France, and Germany instead of Iran, because they were the ones that violated this agreement. But the idea now that Iran will want to come to the bargaining table, will want to discuss the issues with these other countries, when these countries have proven that they're completely unfair, that their positions simply make no sense, this certainly closes any door to future diplomatic efforts. And it's self-defeating for the countries that voted to for these snapback sanctions, because this now precludes the IAEA from inspecting Iranian sites. So what has been accomplished? Nothing except more hostility against a sovereign nation that has done nothing to deserve it.
Well, Mr. Vidadi, if we break in some of the countries that did indeed stand up for another opportunity for Iran, another opportunity for the IAEA to actually reconsider their stance, we have yesterday, of course, they rejected the proposal, the draft proposal by China and Russia. Given the failure of this Russian-Chinese resolution at the Security Council, does this move signal a deeper rift, specifically between the Western and Eastern powers on that council?
100%. If you look at the resolution, wasn't trying to prevent the snapback that they're claiming are taking place now. What they were saying is we want to give 6 more months for negotiations to take place, and that's why we bring this resolution forward. However, now they have stated over a number of weeks now that the snapback mechanism was not applied correctly, and so it's not legitimate and void. And the Russians will be the next president of the council in October. So things are not looking good for the Western bloc. They had this one card up their sleeve politically to trample pressure on Iran through the UN. And they lost that card now, or they used it. And it will be an excuse for military action or strikes. However, they won't be able to impose any more sanctions, extra sanctions. And the previous sanctions were really against the oil and military sales. Now, we know that Iran doesn't really buy military equipment from anyone, and all that it sells is selling to the Chinese companies that are not interacting with the Americans, so they can't be sanctioned. And even now, recently, we saw that Iran has signed a nuclear, 3, 4, or 8 nuclear reactor agreement with Russia. So Russia has stated that even if the sanctions, the Europeans believe the sanctions have come back, they don't believe it is coming back because they've just signed a new nuclear reactor agreement with Iran. So this is definitely, you could call it a rift, but what China is trying, and Russia is trying to say, is that we're trying to maintain the legitimacy of the UN, because if the UN is going to be used willy-nilly and do whatever it wants against Iran or any other country it wants, then there'll be no UN left within a few years.
Mr. Fanti, I mean, wherever we do see problems in the region, we have to bring up the Zionist entity. What role has Israel played in encouraging, actually, the E3 to actually take this step? How should we analyze the regional implications of this decision, in your opinion?
Yeah, this is an important consideration. We have to remember that England and France, very recent, in the last few days, recognized the state of Palestine. And that, of course, is displeasing to the United States and to the Zionist entity. So they had to do something to show their fealty to Israel. And this is one of the things that they can do to accomplish that. Now, this makes no sense, of course, because if we're talking about international law, if we're talking about justice and human rights, then such considerations as bowing to pressure from Western nations, from powerful Western nations, should not be a consideration. But these countries, England, France, and Germany, have done so. The Zionist entity has long considered Iran its mortal enemy. In June, when it attacked Iran, it expected, the leaders of Israel expected a quick and easy victory. They were very disappointed and only survived because they called in the United States to rescue them. So there is always the role of Israel in any kinds of problems and any kind of diplomatic breaks within the Middle East. Israel often has a hand in it, and of course the United States does too, and their goal is never peace and justice, it's power and profits.
Well, Mr. Vidadi, let's go ahead and go over a bit, too. As we know, Iran has time and time again shown that they want the best of the interests of their own nation, their sovereignty, and their rights, basically. When Mr. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi talked about the pooling of the ambassadors, is the recall of the ambassadors from these countries basically a precursor to a complete severance of diplomatic ties with these countries, in your opinion? Or is it basically preliminarily a strong statement of position from Iran?
I would think it's the latter, because if they really wanted to hit the West really hard, they would have blocked all of the NPT agreements and kicked out and no more negotiations with the IAEA and just stopped all cooperation. So Iran, if you look at Iran's history, its diplomatic doctrine isn't to cut ties with countries. So it recalls its ambassador to show it's unhappy with the approach of the EU3, but I don't think they will close their embassy. Don't forget, these countries have large Iranian populations. These Iranian populations require services from the Iranian consulates. It's only the West that always closes Iranian consulates. And if you look at in a couple of years ago, after the Mahsa Amini riots, the Germans closed the Iranian Frankfurt consulate, and it's the Germans that have been putting pressure on Iranian mosques or Iranian institutions. So Iranians are just showing that they're unhappy with the approach, but we have to see how the Europeans, what step they'll take next, because they've used this card, and it hasn't worked so far, but will they use it to cause economic pressure on Iran internally? We have to see in the next week how that works out.
Well, exactly. When we're talking about the Iranian economy, I mean, overall, Mr. Fantina, do you see this new crisis a serious threat to Iran's national security, or is it basically an opportunity to break free from a failed framework and define new rules of engagement?
Yes, I think it's the latter. The Iranian government has dealt with sanctions for years. My contacts in Iran tell me that they're difficult and they're challenging. But the Iranian people, with their technology, their business acumen, their education, they're able to manage despite the sanctions. And we're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see Iran reaching out more to other friendly nations, China, Russia, for example, possibly India, to increase their trade, increase their technological expertise, which they have quite a bit of within the country as it is. They will seek out trade agreements with other nations, thus blocking the impacts of the sanctions from the West. This is the sign of a strong nation, one that has undergone unjust challenges in the past and has dealt with them and will continue to deal with them in the future. So while these are difficult and challenging, especially for the average person, the average citizen in Iran, it is something that the Iranian people will deal with. They're proud of their revolution, they're proud of their nation, and they're not going to bow to Western pressure.
Well, let me go ahead and branch off from Mr. Fantina's answer and bring over to you, Mr. Vidadi. He was mentioning about what he believes perhaps that Iran will be reaching out to others as they have been doing lately. And this is a very complex situation, as we do know. And what should the top priority actually be for Iran at this moment, specifically for Iranian diplomacy? Should they breach out and find new allies? And according to, as Mr. Fantina said, should they have maximum resistance, or should they keep channels open for future dialogue, possibly with Europe?
Well, Ayatollah Raisi, before he passed away, he always said that we will negotiate, whoever negotiates with us, respectfully. However, we will not sit around for negotiations. So that should be the doctrine of this administration in Iran as well, where they recently, just in the last week or so, signed a new preferential trade agreement with Oman, for example. They're increasing their activities on their ports of free trade that they have in Chabahar and Arvand and Kish. If you look at the Iranian websites, there's exhibitions on a weekly basis or multiple occasions in Iran. So the country is not standing still. However, it does need support from the government, the strongest aspect of the, to push the economy forward and to increase its trade with its neighbors. The bilateral countries around Iran is about 15 countries. That's not a small group. And you have countries, as we said, China and Russia already, we know, India already. But there's also African market that it can tap. It can provide a lot of machinery, a lot of raw equipment, a lot of services to these countries, which it does already. So if the government continues to support the economy and the military is doing what it always has done, which is strengthening itself anyway, then there isn't much the West, especially the Europeans and the Americans, can do. And Israel cannot do anything without the support of the U.S. and Israel, Europe. Israel is beholden to them, is part of their colonial outpost, and without their permission and without their cooperation, Israel cannot do much. And it fears that Iran's strength economically will support the countries that are on the axis of resistance. So Lebanon, we saw Dr. Ali Larijani just go to Lebanon again today to show his support for the Lebanese, especially the one-year anniversary of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and Iraq, and all of these countries. And so if Iran's economically strong, and militarily we know it's strong, there isn't much the West can do. And so tide of going to the East, you know, the increase of economy around the world and the strength of economy, cannot be stopped then.
Well, when we're talking about the IAEA, whether we're speaking about the NPT, we have to bring up the JCPOA. Mr. Fantina, considering the recent positions, can we actually declare that the JCPOA is officially and completely dead at this position? And should we be looking for an entirely new framework to try to solve this dispute?
Yes, absolutely. The JCPOA is dead. It's been dead for a long time now. And it's astonishing to me that these European countries, these Western nations, have implemented these snapback mechanisms when it is they who violated the JCPOA. There needs to be a new agreement that will resolve these issues and conflicts. When Donald Trump withdrew from JCPOA in 2018, he said that the Iranian government would come crawling back to him in no time at all for a better deal. Well, it's been 7 years, and there's no sign of that ever happening. So the Iranian government will again approach this from a position of strength, not weakness. The Iranian government, as has been mentioned, is strong militarily and economically, and it was the one party to the JCPOA that maintained it for a full year after the United States and the European signatories violated it. So we will see if there's going to be any agreement at all. It will be a brand new one. The JCPOA is at the point it can't be resurrected now. It is dead, and it's time to move forward. The Iranian government knows that. I don't think the Western nations have quite come to that conclusion yet, but that is reality, and they'll have to deal with it.
Well, Mr. Vidadi, I mean, as we have been seeing, we've been waiting for some time for this decision to come from the Security Council, and they have indeed reinstated these sanctions on Iran. What is a short-term forecast for this crisis, in your opinion, or is it perhaps further escalation of tensions?
Well, short-term, I think it will impact Iranian currency fluctuation. There's a lot of speculators and traders, unfortunately, in Iran who take advantage of these situations to make money. After that, once it stabilizes, I think Iranian businesses, economy, will continue as it has, because no economic extra burden will be added from the sanctions that are supposed to be reimposed by the Europeans, which the Chinese and the Russians do not accept. So then what we will do is you will see that Iranians will now have the JCPOA kind of sword removed over their head. They'll be free to venture forth and find new avenues of economy and relationships. And this idea of negotiation, we'll have to see what will they be negotiating, why are they negotiating, and if they would negotiate, would it be like the JCPOA where Iran for 10 years kind of gave everything that the Europeans and the Americans asked for, but in return received absolutely nothing. So it was a 10-year project that, you know, cost Iran a lot, but it didn't give anything back in return. The cost to benefit ratio was completely against Iran. So I think Iranians not having the JCPOA are now free to venture forth with the other BRICS countries and African countries and South American countries and develop new economic routes and trade and diplomatic relations.
Well, Mr. Fantino, whether we're looking at people vetoing the decision to stop the genocide in Gaza, whether we're talking about who is pressuring the E3 to continue these sanctions on Iran, we have to look towards the U.S., as we have seen. President Pezeshkian, during his latest interview, stressed that the U.S. President Donald Trump has been boasting again about bringing peace to the region. But the path he has chosen would set the entire region on fire. Can we already say that the region is on fire, in your opinion?
Well, the region isn't entirely on fire yet, but it is. The fuse is burning, certainly. The actions of Donald Trump have done nothing to foster peace in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world, for that matter. As you mentioned, he's vetoed the ceasefire in Gaza and thus continued the genocide. His sanctions, the reimposition of sanctions against Iran are not the sign of a peaceful gesture. The consequences of any of these issues the support is continued support of Israel, which has bombed 7 different countries in the last several weeks. This is not a position of peace. This is a position of aggression, of injustice, of violation of international law. So Donald Trump's proclamations about bringing peace to the region are just a lie. They're a myth that exists only in his own brain, and the potential for disaster is there. It could happen momentarily. It will require cooler heads, such as the leaders of Iran and some other Middle Eastern countries and some other Western countries, to maintain some semblance of peace, hopefully bring an end to the genocide very soon, and to enable or to encourage Iranian alliances with different countries with strengthening alliances in trade and military with countries that it is currently working with. This will all be done despite U.S. efforts, not because of them.
Well, Mr. Vidadi, I mean, for too long, as we did mention, all the Islamic Republic of Iran has ever wanted was its rights to be implemented. All they have done was fight against the oppressed, and they have been looking for their interests of their people, as any other person around the world, their freedom and their rights. Mr. Vidadi, do you see one day the Islamic Republic of Iran actually having these sanctions officially lifted and achieving their own rights?
So I think that's the key. What you said is that Iran is a country that is resisting the West. And that's the key point that has the West for the last 40, 50 years trying to dismantle Iran and regime change Iran. And I think that we have to look past sanctions and the Western sanctions. As we discussed, and I think on many shows that Press TV and other, and just even the West has acknowledged now that the swing of power is moving away from the West and it's going towards the East. And when I say East, I don't mean just East, but you know, the global South. Through the BRICS, Africa, South America, all of these countries. The West is losing its colonial power that it had. It's at the final stages of that power. And so Iran doesn't necessarily need for the sanctions to ever be removed. It just needs to continue to survive, and it will thrive. And once the swing of power has shifted enough, Iran will be one of those pillars of the multipolar world that we will have. And it will work with other countries, because other countries like China and India and Russia and African countries have seen that Iran follows the morals and the rules that are set to defend, as you said, the oppressed. And it's not a country of oppressors. So they would look forward to trading Iran once the Americans and the Europeans are so weakened that no one's really then afraid of them.
Well, with that, gentlemen, I'm afraid our time has run out. As always, I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Reza Vidadi, academic researcher and author joining us from London. And, of course, as always, Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. A pleasure to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for now. Goodbye.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Here's a glimpse of what's coming up next on our schedule. For this hour, it's time to listen to For Humanity, hosted by Hujjatul Islam Hamza Azizi. This program covers a variety of subjects concerning human being in the Noble Quran, which include individual and social issues such as the family and how to interact with other faithful Muslims from the point of view of the Holy Quran. And after this program, we shift our focus to economic divide. If you're interested in economic or business issues, then this program is definitely for you. Top experts on the economy give expert analysis and commentary on the biggest business and economic stories of the day. Finally, we present Spring of Truth. Spring of Truth features English translations of selected powerful statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. Please stay with us. Up next is For Humanity.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For Humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Quranic verses and Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in the previous episodes, we ended up talking about the destiny of humanity according to the verses of the Holy Quran, that is the Day of Judgment. And we said it's very important and crucial for us to know what Quran has to tell us about the Day of Judgment. There might be in some religions, I don't know, there might be the source of religion would be the mentality of the followers of that religion. In order to understand, for example, the concept of Trinity, we go to Christians and we ask them, what is Trinity? I don't know if it's true or not. But some religions like that, people go to the followers of the religion and then they conduct survey or whatever, see the mentality as if the source of the religion is the minds of people. It's not true in Islam. In Islam,